I'm really strong on knowing where your limits are. I think that's what makes someone competent. There's nothing more incompetent than working in an area you're not qualified to do and making people believe you are.
Welcome to the Engineering Success Podcast. My name is Mel Sietsma, and I'm the Senior Engineering Consultant here in the team at Nui Tech People. Today, I had the pleasure of being joined by Annie Lacombe. Annie is the Head of Engineering at NGA Thermal. Thanks for joining me, Annie.
Pleasure.
I guess I'd like to get started by just, I guess, a bit of a walk through your career journey so far. Could you tell us why you chose to be a chemical engineer?
As a kid, I was always loving the science stuff. Like, I had a microscope really young and that kind of stuff. I was loving it. I love chemistry. I love maths. I didn't really know what to do. I come from quite modest background. Like, nobody has a engineering degree except one of my uncle was an electrical engineer. And I just fell into it. So I was loving food industry. So I went in food science at uni. Loved it. But then when I started visiting companies, I realized you're really limited to that industry. And then one of the person at uni told me, if you go to ChemEng, you can still work in food industry and other industries. It opens up to you. And the money was a bit better too, and more flexibility. And I wanted to travel for work. ChemEng offered that. So I just kind of fell into it. But I did have a love for science, maths, resolving problems.
Yeah. So you started your career in Canada?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I started in Canada. I did an they were calling it co-op program, the degree. So you do internship while you study. Mm-hmm. So you have like breaks of 4 months to do an internship. And I did one in food industry. And then all the other ones were like in oil and gas close to my parents' house. So it was good to save money and it was interesting. And then they offered me a job after. So I started working with them and did different roles there for about 5 years.
Yeah.
And then I had the hitch to travel. I was like, I did engineering to travel and do like cool project. And that company was called Valero Energy. They really focus on US and Canada. Mm-hmm. So I got an offer for a consulting company to go work for them. So I started in Montreal for them, still in Canada. But then they sent me to New Caledonia to do some commissioning. Then I came to Australia, still with them. And then I got the project I was working on got canceled. And then my visa was in jeopardy. Like, if you don't find another project, you may have to go back to Canada. You still have your job. You may have to go to Canada. And then I got an offer from Orica here to work with them. And they took care of my visa. So that was good. I went to work for them for, a long time, 9 years.
Yeah.
And I did different roles there. So I started like in superintendent in production, went to commissioning manager. And then I had my mat leave. When I came back, I did a global role in continuous improvement. Then I did senior management in production. And after that, I went to Boeing.
Yeah.
As an engineering manager. And then I landed to NGA Thermal. So that's a really quick brief, but I did a few like change in area, a few change in role. It's been an interesting journey for the past 20 years.
Yeah. Pretty impressive though.
Yeah, thank you.
I guess now with your role at NGA, it'd be great to learn a little bit more about what NGA do. So could you share, I guess, for our listeners who aren't as familiar, what NGA does and some of the, I guess, the unique technology that they work with?
Yeah, so NGA is commercializing a technology for thermal energy storage. Why it's unique, we use latent heat. So latent heat is when you put a lot of energy into something to change its phase. So in our case, it's fusion of aluminium, so solid aluminium going to liquid. You can maintain the same temperature. So that means we can have a process that's not too hot. It's 600 degrees. And you can still store a lot of energy because of that change of phase requiring a lot of energy. That's one of the things why we're unique. And also it's local. It was locally developed by people from the University of Newcastle. So that's really interesting fact for the region.
Yeah, I think I've seen some of Alex's demonstrations in the early days showing the muffin in the microwave?
Yeah. They use that analogy to say, like, basically our technology is an inert brick and inside it you have, like, some particulate of aluminium and they're the one who change phase. So the analogy is like the chocolate chip muffin that you have, like, the muffin will stays intact, even if the chip, the chocolate chip inside can get melted. You know, when you bite in it and it's,
Yeah. Awesome. So as far as, I guess, the industries that MGA work in, what industries are best suited to the technologies that you work with and the solutions that you provide?
We're really focusing on industries that use a lot of process heat. Process heat is like where you use heat in your processes for heat, not for making electricity, for example. So an easy one to understand is like the food industry. They'll use a lot of heat to sterilize equipment, and also like a basic one in dairy, they'll pasteurize the milk. It's low temperature. I think it's 72 degrees by memory, but it's still process heat. You need heat. Any industry that uses steam as heat is a good target for us. There's a lot of it in Australia and globally.
Yeah.
Food, beverage, mineral processing, oil and gas, chemical manufacturing as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So I guess we talk a lot about decarbonizing the grid at the moment. How does thermal energy storage work in with that?
I feel it's like the missing part, essential part of the puzzle. So in Australia, for example, 40% of the energy is used for industries. But of that 40%, 50% is used for process heat. And of that 50%, which is like 20% of all the energy for Australia, 90% is still using fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see there's a big need for it. And also renewable are intermittent. That's the, like the wind, solar, they're intermittent. What we need is a way to make them continuous. And all these industry that use process heat, they're normally 24/7. So you need to have the energy at the temperature and that they need, but also continuous.
Yeah. So I guess across the journey so far, MGA Thermal has received some pretty significant funding. What's made you stand out from the crowd to be able to receive that investment?
I feel it's like the need was there. As I said, it's like 20% of all the energy is processed heat and it's 90% from fossil fuel. So there's a need. If we want to decarbonize and meet our target, we need to target that as a big part of that puzzle to get there. So I feel that was really helpful. Also, it's a sound technology. We were able to prove it at scale.
Yeah.
With some of the funding, but we had like proven in the lab. It comes from like deep research. They've been working on it for a long time at university before it got there.
Yeah, cool. And can you share with us where MGA Thermal are up to in their journey so far?
So we commissioned our pilot plant. We've been operating it for 3 months. So that means like we've proven the technology at scale, which is really good. And then we had a big announcement recently. We had completed a pre-feasibility study with a group of industry in Western Australia, which is a huge project to use our technology. We had pre-feasibility. It's like the pre-feasibility is concluded, but if it goes to the next phase, it would be the largest like thermal storage project in Australia. So that's really exciting.
That's super exciting. Yeah. It's nice to see that it's progressing as well.
Yeah. I feel like we're on the momentum. The pilot plan has proven the technology at scale, and then it's that momentum. It can only go up, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it will. Obviously, MGA's going through that startup phase, getting through to commercialization now. What do you see some of the, I guess, key challenges that startup businesses face?
I feel it's like a race for funding. You have to invest a lot to get the technology. Like for us, for example, proving at scale a pilot plan is quite expensive. So it's always that balancing continuous improvement of your technology to compete with the other players in the market and making the most of your funds so you can last enough to get revenue sufficient.
Yeah.
So it's quite a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you think makes a strong business founder in these current times?
I think in this current time, you need to, like said simply, people need to want to follow you. So I think leadership and management has changed a lot. Like, you know, we had the direct in command in the old days when I started working and people just follow you because you say so. Now it's really more influence. People will follow you if they admire you, if they want to be part of your mission, and if they think they're going to learn from you. So business founder need those attributes because that's what will make them have the best staff. And especially the newer generation, it doesn't resonate with them at all, the old style of management that we're used to. It's why it's changed to leadership, not management, I feel. It's like it's really you influence people to want to follow you.
Definitely a lot more of those soft skills and...
Yes.
Yeah. EQ.
Yes. Yeah. I think they say, like, I was reading about it and they were saying, like, you know, emotional intelligence, your attitude, charisma is part of it. And the ability to influence people.
Yeah.
To go in the right direction.
Which I feel would probably be more critical in a startup than a established business.
Yes, it is, because you need to attract talent, but you have less funding to like big industry that are established. So it's really finding that right balance that you attract the right talent, people stay and want to, because it is challenging working in a startup.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure people want to stay working with you. So they need to believe in the mission.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I think I've seen that a few times with startups. Yeah, it's believing that the product is going to succeed.
Yes, you need that trust in the product and that passion for what you're doing.
Yeah, and I guess as far as other people out there looking to maybe change their careers and join a startup, what advice might you give them?
I think from my own experience, when I base it on my own experience, I didn't know what to ask. So make sure you understand their financial situation, how long is their runway, what stage they are, and reflect back on what is my level of risk I'm comfortable with, and does that match what I'm comfortable with? I think it's a really important question to ask yourself, and also understand, like in the interview, be bold, ask the question, and they'll be open to tell you where they are.
Yeah. Just making sure you've done your research a bit.
Yes, and you understand.
Yeah. Cool. So I guess diversity and inclusion continues to be a really, key point in the manufacturing industry. What's been your experience so far in your career in such a male-dominated industry?
It's funny because I've always reflect on it when I have young women working with me. And I feel my dad was a big fan of everyone can do everything. There's no gender, there's no cultural difference that would block you from doing anything. So I always thought I could. And I think I was a bit naive when I went I went from food science, it was 95% women, to chemical engineering, which I was lucky the year I did it was 50-50. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the faculty where I did was probably 10% women for engineering. But my core group in chemical engineering were 50-50. So I was a bit naive. I didn't expect until I started working. But I was fortunate enough that when I started working, the company I work with had a management team in the oil and gas industry. I was 50-50. So again, I think I got sheltered from that. And then when I changed industry, I feel the main challenge for women, I hope it has changed, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago, but the sexual harassment. I was fortunate enough that I had good leaders that addressed it. Sometimes you have to deal with it on your own. I hope it has changed because I know it pushes a lot of women out of that sector.
Yeah.
Because it's stressful. You don't feel safe. Like when you're on a mining camp and you have no social network except your boss and your colleagues and things happen, it can be quite distressful. Mm. So that was the main thing. But also I feel you get put in a box. I call it the box. You're amazing at your job, so we're going to keep you there because you're so good. You don't have the energy. Things are changing, but they used to have what they call you have people who network and they get to know each other and they get the role. So if you're good at your job, it's not necessarily what gets you to move.
Yeah.
You're not part of that club. And unfortunately, that club in some of the industry I work was really male dominated. So then you're not part of it.
Yeah.
So you're amazing at your job. They know you're really good, but you're stuck there because
not part of the boys' club.
Yeah. And they want you to stay there because you're awesome at your job. So they're like, stay there, you're doing what we need. So that's been slightly, I think it really changed for me when I asked someone to mentor me and he said, that's not a mentor that you need, it's a sponsor. That's how you get out of that middle level that you're stuck at.
Yeah.
I was not a manager, I was a supervisor and I was stuck there. And he's like, I need to get you out of that, I'll help you. And it really switched my career from there.
Yeah. And being a female, do you, obviously you just mentioned a male mentor. Is it important to have a female mentor or is it just having a good mentor?
I think it's good to have female allies, because sometimes you need to talk about what you're experiencing with other women. It's totally different approach.
Yeah.
I never really had an official woman mentor. Mm-hmm. I only had male because of the kind of industry I work with. I think it would be good when, I don't think it's necessary, but I think you need the support of men. Like it's a, we call it diversity. It has to stay for both genders.
Yeah.
But I think now that there's more women, it will be more available. Like for me, it was not really available.
Yeah. The industry shifts it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And MGA, I guess, is kind of known for some of their approaches to diversity. Yeah. Could you share with us, I guess, some of the things that they do?
I feel for them, it's really kind of part of their DNA. So it's not, it's like a cultural that they wanted to build with the company. So you don't feel there's that like cultural or gender, like it's really everyone. It's such a diverse team. When I started, I was like, oh, it's the most diverse team I never worked in. So
yeah.
I think they build it from scratch with that cultural approach. So they didn't have to really set target and things like that. They just went with it as part of who they are.
Yeah. And obviously coming to Australia, you're a migrant engineer as well. And I think that's a bit of a changing landscape in Australia as well. Yeah. But yeah, what's been your experience in being a migrant engineer in Australia?
I think you don't realize that when you move, you lose your network. And that network that you've built through your years of career, it's what helps you get promoted. So you get a bit stuck initially. Like you'll have, I feel I had to accept roles and stay longer at a level. Obviously, I think there was part of also, I was not part of the group because I didn't have the network. My style, I got criticized a lot because I'm quite direct. So I had to smooth the way I say things. I had to adjust. But probably the salary. I didn't know the market. I didn't understand. I didn't know where to get that information because it's a new country. And I was a bit naive. I thought, that's what they're offering. It must be what I'm worth. So now I'm way better at negotiating salary than I was at the beginning, but you don't know.
Yeah.
And you linked, depending on which kind of visa you come into, like your job might be linked to your visa. So you feel like I cannot push it too hard because I may lose those benefits of my visa. So it's a really tricky position. Like now that I'm a citizen, now that I understand the market, I know where to find the information. It's really different. But initially I feel I was probably not paid to my value for a few years.
Yeah, and I guess that's tricky. It's both a migrant and a female sometimes.
Yes, it could have been both. Now that they change the regulation and you're not allowed to have your new contract that you cannot discuss your salary. When I started in Australia, it was in all my contracts that you couldn't discuss your salary. Now that it's changed, I feel it opens the doors because especially I find younger generation, they discuss it way more openly.
Yeah.
We still have that stigma that we're not allowed, so we don't do it.
Yeah. More controlled.
Yeah, definitely.
And I guess throughout your career, you've done some interesting courses and training around diversity. Are there any advice to others so they can learn more about the best way to approach?
There's really good organism. Like, for example, NAO, the National Association of Women in Operation. I know big companies, they often have a corporate membership, so their employees are a member. And then through that, you have a lot of free resources. They do a mentoring program as well, which I used to be a mentor for. And through now, when I was still working at Orica, I did the inclusion influencer program with Dr. Karen Morley. And that was really helpful because I was at that pivot point that I wanted to get women in my team in non-traditional role, like the trade and the operation. And I was stuck on how to influence, how to contact the right people. And part of that program, we had like group session, but we also had private coaching with her. And she really helped me get that through. So for me, that was really helpful. For people who don't have time to do a full program like that, she also has books and now has loads of good resources. They have stuff for free on their website. They have a lot of exclusive stuff from Ember. If you don't have a corporate membership, the membership for private is not that dear.
Okay.
I think it's 100 and a bit a year. Like it's really affordable.
Yeah.
And Newcastle has a committee now. It's new. I think it's only a couple of years that we have like a local committee as well. So they do activity. And when you're a member, it's free to attend.
Cool.
Yeah. And that helps because you meet other women. you understand their strategy, how they did. It's really, for me, it was really helpful. I find now was the unblocking for me with Dr. Karen Morley.
She was. I guess talking about committees, you've been, I guess, heavily involved in Engineers Australia in Newcastle in their division. Can you share, I guess, why that's important for other engineers to get involved in organisations such as Engineers Australia?
For me, that was really a turning point from building a network outside my employer, which is really important. Like, we often focused on our internal network, but you need a more broad network of people that you can learn from, that can support you. So that really helped. I joined different committees. So I started with Women in Engineering, which I find was finding that, for me, it was that safe haven. You can go when you're with other women and you can say, oh, I had this happening this week. What would you do? Or just have a proper like whinge. Just get the support from other women. It's so refreshing.
Yeah.
When you're often the only women in a team, that was really good for me. I did the division committee for a couple of years as well, which is the like kind of the board for the region. So that was good experience. So you learn those skills that sometimes can be complementary to your career. Like, I learned to MC events, which I would never have done before. I was always like, oh, nobody wants to hear my accent. I'm not going to talk in a microphone. And then you get pushed to do it, do events, organize them, organizational skills, reaching to people you don't know and say, I think you look awesome. Would you like to come talk to an event we're doing? So it's really good skills for your career as well. But the network is also amazing. Like, the kind of network you build with those volunteering experiences is really good.
Yeah, cool. And I think from memory, so you have some involvement with the migrant engineers group as well.
I forgot. It's a new committee we started about 2 years ago. Yes, I'm involved with this one, which we organize event to help migrant. There's a national support for that because it's one of the focus from Engineers Australia to address like skill force shortage. But we have got a lot of information from the committee in Victoria who's been going on for longer than us. And yeah, it's been really a really interesting one to do, which you came to one of our events.
Yeah.
That's why you remember I'm in that one.
Yeah. Cool. So once again on the Engineering Australia. So you recently achieved your executive engineering status.
Yeah.
Which is something to be really proud of.
Hey, thank you.
So yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Why is that important when you're working in organizations to have that status?
For me, this one, I think like there's two parts, I think, to the question. I'm a strong believer of professional being registered, which is the chartered status, which I have as well. The chartered status is to protect the public, in my opinion. I come, as we discussed before, from Canada. No engineers can work in the country without being registered. And that's to protect the public. So then people are, you know, they have the competency to do their job they're claiming they do.
Yeah.
So overall, it's to protect the public. So I have the charter. I think it's really important. I think there's a lot of discussion on it. It's still not a national approach. Different states are doing different things. So that's something I think is really important. The Eng Exec, it's like it's under invitation, so it's a different process. So for me, it was a really good recognition of my leadership and management in the industry and my involvement for the profession. So that's more like a little, it's really, because it's under invitation, it's like a real recognition, I feel, instead of me applying and getting it, I had to be invited. So
yeah,
I'm really happy and pleased about that one.
Yeah, it's an awesome status to have achieved.
So. Yeah, thank you.
So you've also been nominated for the Excellence Awards for the Professional Engineers in Australia as well. Why are those awards important as far as, I guess, that recognition status?
I think personally, because they do them per region, so Newcastle region includes all the northeast coast of New South Wales, it's really important to recognise like the work that's being done in the region. So there's awards for project, for emergent professional, which is like the younger engineer, professional of the year, and a technical engineer. I think it's really important to recognise like the good work that's been done in every region and the projects. Like engineering, even my friends sometimes don't know what I do.
Yeah.
By recognising project and professionals and individual, you put that hopefully gives awareness to the public what engineering do. It's in everyday life. It's in everything we touch and do. There's some engineering behind it.
Yeah.
So it's an important recognition of that. And it's a celebration of all the cool stuff that we do.
So you're a mum to an 8-year-old daughter and obviously engineering or head of engineering. How do we get the balance right being both a mum and a professional?
You know, the you can have it all is not true. I'm sure you know. For me, part-time has helped at the moment because she has a lot of activities outside school. And even if they put them like at 5 p.m., which is the latest a kid can do something because it means it finishes at 6. Because I work in Tomago, it's still mean. I need to leave work to get her there on time at 4. Yeah. Like max, and sometimes with traffic, you don't know if you're going to get there. So part-time has helped me allow her, but hybrid. I think since we've been allowing people to work hybrid, I work one day from home, it makes a massive difference. I can spend more time with her, not rushing her in the morning of that day, and then my day off. She can just chill before she goes to school instead of being rushed to Oosh. It allows me to spend more time, and it allows her to do activities as well. My partner obviously helped a lot as well.
Yeah.
I was reflecting on it the other day. I think like you need someone to take the load of the kids' stuff or share it, but you cannot, I believe, without external help. Like we don't have grandparents here.
Yeah.
We're both migrants, so we don't have grandparents here. So if you don't have someone to help you, you're not going to be both able to work in a high job full time.
Yeah.
Especially if you have to work on site all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm also a bit of a discipline control freak. So I plan my week really so then I can exercise every day. Even if sometimes I walk the dog every day twice because she's a ball of energy, but then I'll do Pilates, I do other stuff. I plan it really so I can exercise, that my partner can have time, and then we can fit my daughter's activity. And then we can also spend time together and see friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very well organized.
Yeah. I'm over-organized sometimes, like, but it helps me make it work. But yeah, hybrid was a lifesaver.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Yeah.
I don't know, I could do it without it.
I don't know if I could either, actually. It's just been a game changer where you kind of like, we're here now. I don't know if you could ever go to
I don't think nobody
hybrid.
Will want to go back.
Yeah. Yeah. So people often speak about career breaks or career pivots.
Yeah.
How does that affect parents and, you know, I guess making sure you keep that career focus?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I find like a career break, obviously, when you take parental leave, it's a break. What helped me stay, someone gave me the advice, stay connected, even if it's mildly connected. Like you don't need to call every week. You don't have time when you have a newborn, like let's be honest.
Yeah.
But I did keep some kind of connection, especially when my daughter reached 6 months. Mm-hmm. I kept that connection because I took 10 months mat leave.
Yeah.
And then be clear on what you want to come back to. Like reflect on it when you're doing your mat leave. Like they cannot do it for you. You have to say, I want to start back at 3 days for 6 months, ease back in the type of role I want to do. Like I was really clear I wanted to be part-time and I needed it to be more in an office base, not on a site to start with, just because I needed to find my bearing. My daughter didn't sleep until she was 2, so I couldn't be on a site where it was like you're on call, you do long hours.
Yeah.
I needed that little period to readjust. And then I went back to working on a site. But know what you want. And in career pivot, I think it depends. Like sometimes it can be internally to a business. You didn't see it coming. There's restructure. You have a pivot. But sometimes you create them. Like when I change industry, yes, I got offered something, but I took the offer. So yeah. I changed industry. And then what it does as an effect is like, you're never going to be good at something new. Or if you believe you are, you're probably not. Like you have to learn. You're learning a new industry, you're learning a new role, you're learning to work with a new team. So while you're caring also for your own child, it can be quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
Because your brain, like it's so much information, so much stress. Give yourself 6 months. I give that rule of thumb to everyone. Give yourself 6 months before you know if you can cope with that new role or not.
Yeah.
It takes at least 6 months to be comfortable somewhere.
Yeah. And I think even just a new role, let alone pivoting industries like you have.
Yes. Yeah. Pivoting industry was quite challenging. You're like, oh, I know all the jargon people were using, I had no clue in the defense industry. I was like, okay, I'm starting like right at the bottom.
Yeah.
And I'm managing a team and I have to, you don't want to stop them every second word. So you have to take a lot of notes and study your notes and be, then you get into it. But you have to give yourself time. Like it takes time.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's more jargon in probably defense in other sectors.
There's so much.
So you're often, I guess, looked up to as a mentor to some of those younger engineers in the industry. What advice would you give to younger engineers?
You are in charge. I find that's a big mistake. And that's from one of my old manager like that I really respect. He told me that as an advice. If you get a mentor, you are in charge. The mentee, you know what you want to get out of it. You need to organize a session and be prepared. There's nothing worse when you're volunteering for someone and they show up unprepared, late, and they don't know what they want out of the session. Like the person is giving you their time to help you, but you need to know what you're in charge.
Yeah.
I think that's the main advice, because you may get someone who doesn't want to mentor you anymore because of that, or it's just a waste of both your time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I've heard you talk before just around, you know, what makes an engineer competent.
Yeah, I like that one. I'm really strong on knowing where your limits are. I think that's what makes someone competent. It's not, oh, you feel you shouldn't ask questions because you want them to perceive you as competent. There's nothing more incompetent than working in an area you're not qualified to do and making people believe you are.
Yeah,
that's... Know your limits. We do in Canada, have to become registered, we have to do an ethics exam. And part of that ethics exam, the main thing is like, know your limit, know where you're competent, only work in your area of practice that you've qualified.
Yeah.
And that stayed with me, but I see it when I work with people, the good, competent engineer are the ones who say, oh, I don't know that, we need help. Yeah. Engineering is a teamwork anyway. It's a team effort.
Yeah. I think that can be applied to lots of things, even outside of engineering, though.
Anything, yeah.
Yeah.
Work within your area of competency. Everyone would be better.
Know when to stick up your hand and ask for some advice. And
yeah, my first boss ever, when I did my first internship in oil and gas, he told me, there's never a stupid question. There's only a stupid person who didn't ask the question. And he was an old man, and I thought that was really harsh. But he forced me to ask questions. He got me out of my comfort zone. He was making me call people across the business to ask questions and learn. And I remember I was getting home and I was like, oh, I hate this. But it got me to, yes, you can ask questions. You learn from others. That's the main learning. You know that rule, they say 10% formal learning, 90% on the job.
Yeah.
And that's so true. That's how you learn the most.
Yeah. Yeah, just getting out there.
Yes.
When we talk about, I guess, the renewables industry in general, what would you consider to be the main challenges over the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
The fact that they're intermittent, you need a way to make it continuous. Like everyone has it with their solar on their roof. Like you have electricity for the day, but then at night you pay a premium price if you don't have a way to store that energy. That's one of that. But then it needs to be economical. Like the big businesses are not going to go if it's not economical. Like we need to find a way to make it attractive for them to chip in and want to do that full energy transition.
Yeah.
Simple, but yeah.
Yeah. You spoke a little bit, I guess, before about, you know, any outside of work and some of the things you do. But yeah, what do you get up to when you're not at work?
I'm a bit of an exercise freak. I find it's what gets me out of my head. So a few years ago, I got into bouldering, like indoor climbing with no rope. And I do that a lot. I used to do it with friends. Now my partner has joined, my daughter has joined, so we can go as a family. I can also go alone. But that's like, it's like solving a problem on the wall. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, you find out, there you go. It's a lot of scientists and engineers who do it because it gets us out of our head. You have to solve the problem and then physically do it. So that, I do a lot of that. I do a lot of Pilates. I do weightlifting because in my age group, you need to make sure your bones stay strong. I love bushwalking and being in nature. I have, and spending family time and with friends. And I love reading. I'm not a big TV person, but I love reading.
Yeah.
And I find I read a lot in French. It gets me back in that cultural, like, it gives me a little brain break to read in French. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I found a few other ladies and we can exchange books. So that's really nice. Because initially when I moved to Australia, that was my main struggle. Like once a year I was going to Canada, filling my suitcase with books, bringing back. I know you can read on a tablet. I'm an old fashioned. I like the paper.
I'm the same. Yeah.
I just love books.
And is there one piece of advice you've received throughout your career that's kind of stuck with you?
I have two.
Okay.
One was from the first manager I had on projects. So when I worked in oil and gas, we were changing different roles. But after a year, they moved me from, I was more of helping someone with more like operation. And then I moved to projects. And he told me the massive flaw that engineers do is that they don't have rules of thumbs in their heads to understand what people are presenting to them when they're calculating something with a software, if it makes sense or not. So he told me, know your rule of thumbs. And he gave me some basic one. He was a genius for them. I have a few that stuck with me. And then you can see if people like bullshit you when they tell you stuff, just with that rule of thumb in your head. And that was really helpful. Like basic example is like piping, like fluid going through a pipe, calculating the pressure drop. He gave me those little tables. I still have them. And you can just check quickly if it makes sense what people are telling you, or if you put it in a software, if it makes sense. Because we rely so much on computers now to do everything. You still need to have the capacity to assess if what the computer is giving you is right.
Yeah.
So that was a really good advice. And the second one was just say what's kind and necessary in your life in general, but also in the workplace, because people go to work to do their best. They don't intend, you know, nobody goes to work to make a mess. And so be kind and make sure it's necessary what you're saying. It would be a better workplace for everyone. And I often have to practice that one, like, you know, the necessary bit. Kind, I'm like, okay, sometimes everyone can slip it, you know.
Yeah.
But the necessary, sometimes keep what you want to say for yourself because it's not required.
Yeah.
It's not going to change anything if you say it. So that one is a continuous work in progress.
I like it, though. It's good.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was a good discussion. Thank you.